thanks so much for being with us. Darren Byler, anthropologist at the University of Colorado Boulder, speaking to us from Seattle, Washington. And that does it for our broadcast. A very happy birthday to Hugh Grant. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Please stay safe. Wear a mask. Where to? I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Southeast Portland hit-and-run suspect is indicted on 31 charges, including murder. How a new law in Congress could protect thousands of miles of Oregon's rivers. And inching closer to a vote on pandemic relief as Democrats take power in Washington, D.C. Good evening. Thanks for joining us for the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 4th, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. There are 7 new COVID-19-related deaths recorded in Oregon. This raises the state's death toll to 1,998. The Oregon Health Authority reported 730 new confirmed and presumptive cases today. This brings the state's total to 145,320. Today, OHA also reports that it added more than 15,000 new doses of COVID-19 vaccinations to its registry. Oregon has now given out more than 486,000 first and second doses of COVID vaccines. There are 261 people hospitalized with COVID across Oregon. 58 of those are in intensive care. That's 5 fewer than yesterday. Throughout the U.S., more than 26.6 million people have become infected. The virus is linked to more than 451,000 deaths. And worldwide, there are 105 million infections and 2.28 million deaths. President Biden's administration is considering sending masks to every American household. The White House is looking at the logistics of sending out the masks directly to hundreds of millions of people. Biden has also asked Americans to wear masks for the first 100 days of his term. Meantime, The Guardian reports that Indigenous Americans are dying from COVID at twice the rate of white Americans. One in every 475 Native Americans has died since the pandemic began. That's higher than in any other group. Nationwide, the deaths have claimed one in every 825 white Americans and one in every 645 black Americans. It was a hit-and-run crime that left a woman dead and a community in trauma in Portland. Now a driver answers to a lengthy criminal indictment claiming he is not guilty. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the latest on the story.
An Oregon City man implicated in a deadly Southeast Portland hit-and-run rampage last week is being held without bail after entering pleas of not guilty to a 31-count indictment in a Multnomah County courtroom Thursday morning. The indictment charges 64-year-old Paul Rivas with second-degree murder and failure to perform duties as a driver in the January 25th killing of Gene Garrick, a pedestrian who was hit twice and then dragged for a block. Garrick, who was 77, died 3 hours later from blunt force trauma at OHSU Hospital. Police declared her death a homicide. In addition to Garrick's death, seven other people were injured during Rivas' hit-and-run spree that occurred over several blocks in southeast Portland. Six of those hit by the driver were hospitalized for treatment, according to police, who maintained that Rivas deliberately hit people, though they could not find evidence suggesting his actions were motivated by terrorism, bias, or politics. After colliding with another vehicle, Rivas fled the scene on foot, where he was corralled by a group of nearby pedestrians before being arrested by Portland police. Rivas is facing a multitude of charges in addition to the second-degree murder charge, including seven counts of second-degree attempted murder, eight counts of failing to perform the duties of a driver, seven counts of second-degree assault, seven counts of first-degree attempted assault, and one count of resisting arrest. During Thursday's courtroom appearance, Rivas remained ducked down and largely out of sight, with only his cuffed hands remaining visible during much of the arraignment. Rivas is originally from Kansas and, according to arrest reports, has been living in a fifth-wheel trailer in Oregon City for the last 13 years. Following his arrest, Rivas told court officials that he receives supplemental security for a disability and that he has been diagnosed with anxiety and depression in the past. Rivas' next court date is set for March 19th. He was represented by court-appointed attorney Jonathan Saar. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
A member of the Proud Boys who brawled at Portland protests is facing charges for the U.S. Capitol riot. Yesterday, federal officers arrested Ethan Nordian, who describes himself as the sergeant of arms for the Seattle chapter of the far-right group. The Associated Press reports the 30-year-old is facing charges of obstructing or impeding an official proceeding, aiding and abetting, and knowingly entering or remaining in a restricted building. The most serious charge could bring a 20-year prison term. He is at least the eighth member of the male chauvinist and extremist Proud Boys group facing federal charges connected to the storming of the U.S. Capitol, as Congress was meeting to certify Joe Biden's presidential victory. Nordian appeared in federal court in Seattle yesterday with a public defender. The FBI says they arrested him at his home in Auburn, south of Seattle. The Southern Poverty Law Center says Nordian is known for fighting with Antifa demonstrators in Portland. Prosecutors say he had been posting before the Capitol riot, including a caption reading, "Let them remember the day they decided to make war with us." He also posted about what he described as blatant, rampant voter fraud. Recent findings are showing that most victims of Vancouver police shootings had unaddressed mental health needs. The data comes from an OPB analysis. It examined the 18 people Vancouver police shot at since 2011, reviewing thousands of pages of investigative records and interviewing victims' family members. At least nine of the 18 people showed signs of heightened behavioral distress during police encounters. In 2020, Vancouver police were involved in three shootings, with all three individuals having previously diagnosed mental illnesses. Two of the three shot were killed, while the third is paralyzed from the waist down. Kim Molsoff of Disability Rights Washington says these statistics echo national data and that she is alarmed but not surprised. A lack of centralized tracking across jurisdictions identifying cases where the use of force against people with behavioral problems occur is partly to blame, according to Molsoff. She added, as a society, we are not meeting the behavioral needs of many people, but instead are waiting for them to fall into crisis before we react. Vancouver Police spokesperson Kim Kapp says any time a police officer is put in a deadly force encounter that results in the loss of life, it is a tragedy. Kapp also says officers are being asked more and more to solve mental health issues. Efforts have been made in Vancouver, as well as several other U.S. cities, to partner police with specialists trained at identifying mental crisis, diffusing potentially volatile confrontations, and helping people get treatment. Families of victims say the efforts are just not enough. William Abe and Andrew Williams were killed by Vancouver police in 2020, and both had mental health conditions. Both families say they received no assistance from the department or the city of Vancouver in helping them bury their dead. Treva Smith, Abe's aunt, says the city doesn't help. Even though the city's police killed him, there is zero offer of assistance. Since 2011, every shooting by a Vancouver police officer has been deemed justified. Abe's and Williams' families say they do not have the money or hope to challenge Vancouver police in court. A proposed 4,700 miles of protected rivers and streams in the River Democracy Act are located across the state of Oregon. As Eric Tegedoff reports, Oregonians have now selected the rivers for protection in a congressional bill.
New legislation in Congress would protect rivers Oregonians have identified as their most cherished. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley released the River Democracy Act on Wednesday after hearing from nearly 2,500 Oregonians about which rivers they want protected. The bill would give 4,700 miles of rivers and streams across Oregon wild and scenic river designation. Chad Brown is president and founder of Soul River and a Navy veteran. He says Oregon's rivers are places where people can recharge.
The river is a special place, and it's definitely a place of medicine, of natural medicine, that we all need to enrich our soul, our mind, our body, and our spirit.
Brown says rivers help him and other veterans cope, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. About 2% of Oregon's waterways are currently protected as wild and scenic. Wyden's office received more than 15,000 nominations for river miles across the state. Opponents of wild and scenic designations worry it could impact industry along rivers and streams. Liz Hamilton heads the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. She says the bill bodes well for protecting salmon and steelhead and boosting the state's outdoor recreation sector, which generates $15.6 billion in consumer spending and is a boon for rural economies. Hamilton says Wyden has worked on protecting Oregon rivers for decades and that the state could sustain more recreation.
Our industry in particular has learned that there's not enough public spaces for people. The access has been crowded and the need for more public space is really clear to us through this pandemic.
Hamilton also notes the bill would help protect clean sources of water, especially from wildfire risks. The legislation ensures only federal lands are affected by wild and scenic designations, and that Native American tribes have a voice in how rivers are managed. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
12 Oregon nonprofits that help people facing inequities received $5 million in grants today. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum announced the grants, which provide relief for groups representing communities such as LGBTQ+, Latinx, and BIPOC domestic abuse survivors. Rosenblum based the decisions on a report after 24 hours of comments from Oregonians over a series of 12 community conversations last year. Amid complications from COVID-19, the conversation switched to a statewide virtual format, which allowed more than 1,000 people from all across the state to participate. Jackie Vargas, who works with Northwest Family Services and Casa Esperanza, the Latinx domestic violence shelter, says, quote, RAG is hearing us, and I think that's a step starting the process and being heard. Casa Esperanza got a 3-year grant worth more than $300,000, enabling the shelter to ramp up their efforts to fight rising numbers of domestic violence cases within the Latinx community. The past year has been challenging for nonprofits to secure funding amid the pandemic. Bree Condon, the executive director of Bradley Ankle, a resource center for the LGBTQ plus community and shelter for domestic violence victims, explains it's really challenging to get the funding when you're trying to serve marginalized communities. In the last 12 months, we've had a better time getting money from the East Coast, like Massachusetts and D.C., than we have locally. Bradley Ankle will receive $250,000 to be spread out over the next 3 years. Some of the other groups that will be receiving the grants include Bridges Oregon, the African Youth and Community Organization, Disability Rights Oregon, and Raphael House of Oregon. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on this World Cancer Day. What are some of the new advances giving people hope? And how are disparities in cancer treatment and diagnosis still hurting African-American communities? At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, it'll be cloudy with occasional rain down to an overnight low of 44. Tomorrow's weather, showers early on Friday, trickling out later in the day, a high of 51. For the weekend, more showers on the way with highs in the upper 40s. Today in history, on this date in 2004, a Harvard sophomore named Mark Zuckerberg launched the Facebook, a social media website he built to connect students with each other. It ballooned into one of the most important social media companies in the world. The quote of the day is from Mark Zuckerberg, who said, "Move fast and break things. Unless you are breaking stuff, you're not moving fast enough." In the U.S. Congress, House Republicans decide not to punish Marjorie Taylor Greene or Liz Cheney themselves, and instead go after Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Harvard constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe thinks the House lawmakers should remove Greene from committee assignments, including education. And across the aisle, in the U.S. Senate, the Democrats finally take control. They could vote on a COVID relief package as soon as tomorrow. With more on these stories, here's Laura Ross-Brotellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're tracking our democracy in historic times.
Are there any other members who wish to testify on H.R.E.S. 72?
The House of Representatives vote today will determine whether their Republican colleague Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia will keep her leadership positions on key committees. The freshman rose to national headlines for promoting violent actions, racist rhetoric, and debunked conspiracy theories. The House GOP overwhelmingly voted yesterday evening to not punish Greene themselves and let Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming keep her post as the third most powerful House Republican. Cheney voted to impeach Trump. During the House Rules Committee's debate yesterday, Republican Representative Michelle Fischbach of Minnesota argued against the resolution.
This would be setting a new precedent, and one that I think could be very dangerous. It's a precedent where the majority party can punish a member of the minority party by removing them from their committee assignments.
On the other side, Fox News reports that House Republican lawmakers are proposing an amendment to the Green resolution that would strip Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota from her committee assignments. She made comments a couple years ago criticizing Israeli policy that some considered anti-Semitic. Omar later apologized. While it is unusual for the House to remove people from committee assignments, Harvard constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe says Congress has the power to do so and thinks they should.
If this isn't a good case for exercising this constitutional authority, I can hardly imagine one that would be.
In other business, the House narrowly passed a budget resolution for President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill. Senate Democrats could approve their version as early as Friday, with no Republican support, prompting GOP lawmakers to criticize the Biden administration for partisan tactics. Senate Majority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer of New York responds,
"We want to do it bipartisan, but we must be strong. We cannot dawdle, we cannot delay, we cannot dilute, because the troubles that this nation has are so large."
Republicans do support the extra $1,400 stimulus checks, which Biden has promised, for lower-income individuals only. In other Senate news, a new power-sharing agreement finally allows Democrats to take committee chairmanships, following weeks of negotiations over how to manage an evenly divided Senate, with Vice President Kamala Harris as the tie-breaking vote. The New York Times reports that some Trump loyalists in the Department of Homeland Security, specifically the union representing ICE agents, could resist Biden's new actions on immigration. On the Trump impeachment trial, more than 370 congressional aides released a letter yesterday calling for the former president's conviction, pro-Trump lawyer L. Lynn Wood, who sued unsuccessfully to block the certification of election results in Georgia, is now being investigated by Georgia election officials for allegedly illegally voting in the state. Lastly, the House will now fine members who refuse to go through metal detectors installed outside the House since the Capitol riot, $5,000 for a first offense and $10,000 after that. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rossbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
A new report shows President Biden's relief package could help reduce child poverty. As Eric Galatis reports, expanding the access to the child tax credit is expected to provide as many as 99% of families with children with an additional $2,200 on average.
President Joe Biden's proposal to expand the child tax credit would help reduce child poverty and extend the credit to nearly half of all Black and Hispanic children, according to new analysis by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Amy Hanauer with the Institute says the move will help working people in Nebraska who actually pay a larger share of their income in payroll, sales, and other state and local taxes, but don't earn enough to pay federal income tax.
The changes to the child tax credit no longer punish you for being in that situation, and they say, okay, your child deserves a credit just like any upper middle income child would deserve a credit.
Hanauer says expanding access to the cash back credit, part of the administration's COVID relief plan, would put an additional $2,200 on average into the pockets of 99% of Nebraska families with children. Previously, only wealthy and middle income families could claim the credit. Critics have warned that Biden's relief package would increase the budget deficit and give money to people who are not currently struggling economically. Hanauer notes that lawmakers now opposed to sending $1,400 in direct payments to workers had no concerns about expanding deficits when tax cuts put $50,000 on average into the pockets of America's wealthiest families. She believes Biden's plan will help struggling families and state and local economies.
We're making sure that the poorest people and those who really, really need it get help, but we're making sure that this is really something that's helping almost all of us. And that will in turn be reinjected right back into the economy because people have been holding back on spending.
In addition to cash payments and the child tax credit expansion, Biden's plan also calls for increasing the earned income tax credit. Hanauer says these three measures would send targeted relief to the bottom 60% of taxpayers who would see an average benefit of $3,500. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
Families of people with disabilities are getting more support under a new program focusing on people who live in rural communities in the West. Eric Tegedoff tells us how this could impact the Banna family with five children, including a daughter with a disability.
Families with people who have disabilities can sometimes feel isolated because of their experiences. Siblings of people with physical, developmental, or mental health diagnoses especially have unique experiences, which includes challenges and rewards. Abby Guza is a licensed clinical social worker who hosts SIB Shops, which provide support for Montana families who have a child with a disability. She says siblings sometimes feel as if their parents' attention is pulled away from them, but ultimately they're resilient.
They're really proud of their ability to help that brother or sister out. And I see a lot of kids who have a really incredible amount of knowledge, oftentimes well beyond their years, about what their sibling with a disability needs.
Guza says these families can feel alienated and are even more isolated than usual because of COVID-19. While her SIB shops can't happen in person, Guza is hosting three virtual sessions with families over the next month, starting with a session for parents and caregivers on February 22nd. Grace Lee Banna's older sister has a neurodevelopmental disability that has slowed her capacity for picking up new skills. Banna says there are ups and downs with her sister.
I've learned to be more willing to help, even though at first I did not want to help at all. But the other half of it is honestly kind of fun to be able to try new things with her and be able to teach others about her, like my friends or anyone that comes across her.
Grace Lee's mother, Jen Banna, is coordinator for the Montana Family-to-Family Health Information Center, based at the Rural Institute for Inclusive Communities. The center helps families navigate health care and also help providers, state agencies, and lawmakers understand the needs of families who have children with special needs.
We believe that the health of the family, including the mental health, is improved when we provide resources that help families cope better with the special conditions that their kids have.
The deadline to register for Guza's SIB Shop, which is hosted by the Montana Family to Family Health Information Center, is Monday.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
One tribe has to extend their lockdown due to a surge in COVID-19 infections. An Apache stronghold goes to court trying to protect a sacred site. And a Cherokee Nation leader weighs in on a Freedmen challenge. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leaders of the Hopi tribe in northern Arizona have extended a lockdown order for residents amid a continued surge in new COVID-19 cases. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports the tribe has one of the highest rates of new infections in the country.
Hopi officials say they've confirmed more than 100 new known COVID cases in the past 2 weeks. It continues a sustained spike that began in the fall. In all, nearly 1,200 members of the 9,000-person tribe have tested positive since the pandemic began. One worrying number for Hopi health officials is the tribe's percentage of positive tests, a key indicator for virus spread, which is more than 25%. That's over three times the national figure and higher than Arizona's statewide percentage. This week, the tribe extended its reservation-wide lockdown order until March 1st. It requires masks to be worn at all times in public and puts nightly and weekend curfews in place. Residents are also prohibited from gathering with people outside their households, along with several other restrictions. According to the order, those who violate it face criminal penalties. Most of the tribe's 12 villages have closed access to non-residents during the pandemic. Officials say travel between villages and off the reservation continued to be a primary driver of new COVID infections. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A nonprofit advocating for the protection of a sacred site in Arizona went to court Wednesday to try and stop a proposed copper mine. Emma Gibson with Arizona Public Media has more.
Over the course of the preliminary injunction hearing, the nonprofit Apache Stronghold talked about the religious and cultural importance of Oak Flat, the site Resolution Copper wants to mine. Nolan Pike, a member of the group and of the San Carlos Apache tribe, testified at the hearing.
It saddens me to the fact that I had to go and get questioned about my religion, about my way of life, and how it is to pray and what it means, and to try to convey that message to the judge so that he can make the right decision.
Apache Stronghold also claims the land was to remain in Apache ownership, according to a treaty signed in 1852. The judge says he will decide whether or not to issue a preliminary injunction, temporarily stopping any progress on the mine by next Friday. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
The leader of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma is weighing in on a challenge to a Freedmen descendants run for tribal office. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. in a statement Wednesday said the challenge is offensive. Hoskin says Freedmen descendants are equal and full citizens under the law, including the right to seek public office. An eligibility complaint was filed this week after Cherokee Freedmen descendant Marilyn Van filed for candidacy for tribal council. The Cherokee Phoenix reports the complaint by Cherokee citizen Robin Mays states Van is not Cherokee by blood as required by the Constitution. There have been long-fought political and legal challenges over the status of freedmen, descendants of former Cherokee-owned slaves. Freedmen were granted rights of Cherokees through treaty in the 1800s. In 2017, courts ruled they are full Cherokee citizens under the law. The complaint has been sent to the Election Commission's attorney. Van told the Tulsa World she would fight in court if necessary. The general election is scheduled for June. Flags on the Navajo Nation are at half-staff in honor of former President Albert Hale, who passed away this week at age 70 after complications from COVID-19. He was Navajo Nation president in the 90s and later served in the Arizona legislature and was a member of the Navajo Nation Bar Association and the New Mexico Bar Association. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Signs of a heart attack in women can be the same or different from those in men. They include chest pain, shortness of breath, nausea, and back or jaw pain. As Diane Bernard reports, a campaign this month spotlights women's top killer, heart disease.
Heart disease is women's number one health threat, and the American Heart Association is raising awareness of this alarming fact with its DC Go Red campaign. The program encourages women in Washington, DC and Virginia to take an active role in their health, as well as that of those they love, according to Jill Felden with Kaiser Permanente, which is co-sponsoring the Greater Washington campaign. She says too many women, particularly young women of color, are unaware of the dangers of cardiovascular disease, which kills 1 in 3 Black and Caucasian women in the nation. She thinks the campaign is timely because heart disease has killed more people in 2020 than COVID-19.
The pandemic has created a lot of stress for people, which has an impact on people's heart health. So it's really important to get the message out about keeping your heart healthy, what you can do to prevent cardiovascular disease, and to definitely talk to your doctor about any heart questions that you might have.
National Wear Red Day on Friday, part of the association's February Heart Month focus, also asks folks to wear red and download resources to help eradicate heart disease and stroke. For more information and to make donations, go to dcgored.heart.org. Felden says some of the ways women can stay heart healthy is to pay attention to risk factors in their cholesterol, blood sugar, and weight numbers. They also should talk to their doctors about any family history of cardiovascular disease.
A second thing you can do is certainly make healthy lifestyle choices, move more, eat smart, and manage your blood pressure. These things are in some ways kind of small, but these small things can really add up and make a big difference in terms of how you live.
About 6% of Virginians live with a variety of cardiovascular disease, according to the Virginia Department of Health. In 2017, CDC data shows heart disease was the second leading cause of death in the Commonwealth, killing almost 15,000. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 4th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Althea Billings, Eric Tegedoff, Diane Bernard, Laura Ross-Brotellum, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Pacifica Network. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. We have much more still ahead on KBOO News in depth, including a look at advances and disparities on this World Cancer Day and the Consumer Product Safety Commission's effort to prevent more kids' injuries and deaths as they shelter in place at home during the pandemic.
KBOO News in depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Some new information that's come out about injuries in homes. You did some research on this, is my understanding. I wanted to find out what you found out in this research.
Yes, Annette, we've been looking at this very closely. And with everyone being at home almost a year now with COVID, more people are watching TV. You've got kids that are climbing on furniture and doing exploring more. You've got parents and caregivers who are so distracted because it's a home, it's a gym, it's a schoolhouse, it's a job, an office. And so with all of those combination of factors, it's increasing the chance of a TV or a furniture tipping over and hurting a child. When you put into that, the Super Bowl is around the corner, so that's even more TV watching. More people have gone out to buy new TVs for the Super Bowl, or they got holiday specials over the last couple months. And so with all of that, it increases the danger of the tip-overs. Our study shows that in the past 19 years, 450 children have died, unfortunately, tragically, because of this kind of furniture tipping over. And each year, on average, there's been about 11,000 kids going to the emergency room from injuries with these tip-overs of furniture and TVs. The kids that are involved, we're talking most of them are under 6 years old. They're toddlers. And almost 75% of their fatalities involved a TV tipping over. So all the more reason now, with everyone focused on the TV especially, we want to bring this to your attention.
And Alyssa, you've had a firsthand experience with something like that. What happened? It sounded pretty scary.
It was definitely scary. And here is my story. About a year ago, just under a year ago, I was at work and our nanny had put our daughter down for a nap. And about 20 minutes later, she heard a large thud and our child was screaming and crying. And she went to see what happened and discovered that the dresser had tipped over and she had somehow managed to escape. Before she was really pinned under there, she kind of got out from under it and her foot was still kind of trapped, but she was able to get it out from under a crevice under the dresser. So we were very fortunate that she wasn't seriously injured from that tip over, but after that, it certainly was a wake-up call.
Wow. What message would you have for other parents?
My message would be to make sure that your furniture is anchored to a wall. Our daughter had never been a climber. She was 3 and a half when this happened, and it didn't happen until it happened. So just because your child isn't climbing doesn't mean that they won't. It doesn't mean that they can't. And our daughter had seen something on top of the dresser that she was interested in. It might have been a little toy. We're not sure. But she had taken the drawers out of the dresser and climbed up those drawers to get that item. And that is when the weight of the dresser fell on top of her. So do yourself a favor and make sure that any piece of furniture is securely anchored to the wall, because this could happen to you. It could happen with a TV. It could happen with a bookshelf. Anything heavy is likely to possibly topple over on top of these kids if they reach for something.
Uh-huh. What was going through your mind as a mom? I'm just trying to figure out, you know, when you knew this happened to Eris. Yeah, when you found out this happened to Eris, what was going through your mind as a parent?
I felt horrible. And in fact, I was so embarrassed, ashamed, and really felt so much guilt that it took me 5 days to even tell my mom that this had happened, because I felt like I was an awful parent. I knew that these sort of things could happen. And we just kind of figured she had skipped past the climbing stage and we were fine. But just know that you may think it may never happen to you, but it can.
But she's okay now?
She's fine. She was very lucky. She didn't have to go to the doctor or anything.
Wow. Amazing.
Annette, if I can add something there.
Please, yes.
We did a survey, and a lot of parents and caregivers say, well, you know, I don't need to anchor furniture because I watch my children. And the reality is that goes wrong more often than you want it to. We put together a PSA with some of the nanny cams and some of the real-life footage of parents watching the children, and they can't catch it fast enough. It happens in a blink of an eye. The TV falls, the furniture falls, and there's nothing you can do about it. That's why we want to have parents be on the lookout now and take the steps to avoid this happening in the future. Get an anchor kit. Sometimes they come with the TV or with the furniture, and if not, you can buy it online or at your local hardware store or your home improvement center. About $5, and it takes about 5 minutes. Simply screw it in the back of the furniture and screw it into the wall. $5 in 5 minutes can save the life of your child.
That's amazing. Okay. Joseph, you know, with Super Bowl coming up, what would your best advice be to families who are hearing about this?
The best advice is everyone's excited about the game. Just take these few minutes, get that Anchor It kit, order it, and when you get it, put it together right away and just take care of this so that you have peace of mind while you're watching the game. Because everyone's distracted during the game. If you're not going to use an Anchor It kit, be sure you put it on TV on a low base and push it back on the shelf as much as you can. And whatever you do, don't tempt toddlers. Don't put toys or candy or the remote control up high for them to climb. Put the heavier things lower on a bookcase. And when you got the new TV, and a lot of people bought TVs for Super Bowl or from the sales last year, you recycle the old one. If you're going to keep the old one and put it into another room, say the kids' room, by all means, anchor it in there because the danger goes with the TV set.
Have you seen hard evidence of an uptick in children's injuries since COVID began?
We haven't noticed that yet because we're still looking at the numbers, but the study we've done shows that these accidents and these deaths are happening at the same level as before. We were hoping it would be going down, but it's not. And so with more TVs out there and more congestion at home where everyone's distracted and kids are running around, it's just increasing the chance of danger here.
Anything else I haven't asked either of you you'd like to add?
Do you want to go ahead and give that website?
Yes, by all means, you can go to anchorit.gov and you'll see plenty of videos to show you how to do this and information about it so that anyone who's hesitant can get the information that they need.
Okay.
And lastly, I would just say, when it comes to the bruises and the injuries, let's leave that on the football field during the Super Bowl. Let's not have it be in your home and with your kids. Anchor it.
Joseph and Alyssa, thank you so much to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The American Society of Clinical Oncology is releasing its annual report on progress against cancer. Joining us is Dr. Howard A. Burris III, the ASCO's past president. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the key findings on the fight against cancer right now?
So each year, ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which is the world's largest professional organization, more than 40,000 members representing those that are cancer caregivers, physicians, researchers, publishes this report. And this year we're highlighting advances and successes in gastrointestinal cancers, and in particular we're understanding the genetic basis of those cancers, the molecular profile of those cancers has made a difference in the treatment approach.
And you're talking about that as the advance of the year. What's new and special about it?
So GI cancers, gastrointestinal cancers, so esophagus, our swallowing tube, all the way down to the pancreas, colorectal cancer, almost a dozen different diseases. About a quarter of the world's cancer cases and about a third of the world's cancer deaths has lagged a bit behind in terms of where some of these advances have made an impact. So we have seen, through understanding what's driving these cancers, that utilizing immunotherapies in groups of colon cancer patients has improved outcomes, that utilizing new treatment approaches in liver cancer and then gastric cancer have had patients live longer and do better. Lynch syndrome, the most common familial hereditary type of colon cancer, just taking a baby aspirin a day reduced the occurrence of colon cancer by almost 50%. So the other end of the prevention screenings of situation versus just treating the cancer.
Okay, let's talk a bit about, you know, something else that's come up in some of the research is disparities, that some people are not benefiting from all the advances in technology and treatments that have come in the last, say, 10 years or so. And what are some of the groups of folks that you're most concerned about right now?
Yes, that's an excellent topic. And unfortunately, the elderly, some of our patients that live in rural communities, some that are financially, socioeconomically disadvantaged are not benefiting. And then in particular, many people of color, particularly blacks, are not seeing the benefits of these advances in cancer treatment. So those are important issues in health equity, trying to make sure that we've got access for trials, access to research, access to care for those populations. Our current president, Dr. Lori Pearson, the University of Michigan, has a wonderful presidential theme this year, actually initiated before the pandemic and much of the strife in the country, that simply was every patient, everywhere, every day. And that's a great motto.
Mm-hmm. How is the COVID pandemic affecting the diagnosis and treatment of cancers?
So when the pandemic started, there were some pauses in clinical trials and cancer care, but that was short-lived. I mean, cancer care is certainly not elective. But on the other hand, cancer screening, so mammography, colonoscopies, other tests that can help us detect cancer earlier, and cancer detection early is the best way to have a great outcome. We saw those plummet to near zero. Now, while they're beginning to return to baseline, there's not an overshoot. So that means that one can assume most of these patients simply have delayed their tests for a year or more. And it'll take a while to see the impact of that. But we're already beginning to see patients coming into the clinic now with more advanced cancers that might have been picked up sooner if they'd had their screening tests.
So what's your advice to people who might be afraid of going to the doctor right now because there's a pandemic for their regular checkups?
It's a real issue. I would say that the hospitals and clinics that I've visited, and we hear this from my colleagues across the country, spacing appointments to help with social distancing, eliminating the waiting room phenomena, calling patients in from their cars or other avenues, all those are being done to be protective, the wearing of masks. And then fortunately, particularly starting now, virtually all of the healthcare workers have had the opportunity to get the vaccine. So I think those are impacts. And I would encourage patients not to wait the year. If you were due in July and you missed it, go in now. I mean, there's no reason to wait till your regularly scheduled yearly appointment. Don't get too far behind the curve.
What is your message about this World Cancer Day?
So World Cancer Day, February 4th, it occurs every year about this time. It's an international effort to increase awareness about cancer, education, treatment, research, participation. It really is a great call to thinking about cancer. That's one of the stories. I think education and awareness is so vital. Our cancer.net website, cancer.net, is a place that we have for patients and families and loved ones and the lay public to get information on more than 120 different cancers. And then our Cancer Advances Report is actually on our ASCO.org, ASCO.org website. Those are great tools as well. But really a place to stop and think about your health. Think about your weight. Think about exercising a little bit, doing things you can, getting to your screening appointments so that this all-too-common disease is, if it's going to be detected, gets detected at the earliest stages. And if you can take steps to prevent it, then all the better.
And we happen to be located in the Pacific Northwest, mostly Washington and Oregon is where our listeners are. Do you know if the ASCO has a presence here or is involved in any research in our area?
Yes, we do. We've actually got leadership that are coming from Washington State and Oregon, partnering with not just the universities there, but many of your community practice leaders are involved with ASCO. The American Society of Clinical Oncology's new chief medical officer, Dr. Graylow, comes from the Seattle Cancer Alliance. So a lot of great things are going on in the Pacific Northwest, and those have been cities that have been very involved and states that have been involved in a number of our initiatives. So a great part of the program.
Yeah, I don't know if you know that the Knight Cancer Institute is located here. So there's a lot of promise and hope there.
Yeah, the Knight Cancer Institute, Dr. Drucker, and colleagues from that particular university have been leaders on the research front as well as the advocacy front and really pushing for these research initiatives. So the Knight Cancer Institute is something that's known well to ASCO and the world, and you should be very proud of that resource.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else I haven't asked you you'd like to add?
You know, just, again, continue to push the education and awareness initiative, trying to get the federal government to realize how important it is to continue funding these initiatives, not just at those facilities, but researchers across the country and all of our states. And in the Pacific Northwest, Knight and Seattle Cancer Alliance and others get some federal funding to help research initiatives. And to continue to get your screening and try to be healthy. Be up and aware about the possibility of cancer and do what you can to help yourself.
Wonderful. Okay, well, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
All right. You too. Have a great day.
You too. And that was my conversation with Dr. Howard Burris III, ASCO's past president. That's the American Society of Clinical Oncology.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today. So this is one of my favorite segments in which I get to review some of the interesting public health research that has come out in the past week. So let's go ahead and get started. Nigeria struggles to develop accurate COVID death count. Now, at the beginning of the pandemic, the UN predicted massive loss for the continent of Africa and actually so did we here on COVID Noise Filter. Now, in response to this, nations such as Nigeria have imposed strict lockdowns that kept their numbers presumably low as rates rose in other countries. Now, there wasn't a way to know for sure, though, because nations such as Nigeria didn't have much of an infrastructure in place to track deaths. When a city in Sudan saw a massive hidden outbreak in November, it led to global speculation about the death rates of COVID-19 in other African countries. Now, the lack of reliable data has allowed health experts to make differing extrapolations. Now, Nigeria needs to be able to track the death rates to correct this and to catch outbreaks when they happen. Now, there are a series of problems with Nigeria's mechanisms for tracking deaths. Many registrars have been misidentifying causes of death for COVID-19. Each month, registrars in each region tally up what caused the deaths they registered, and much of that documentation doesn't have COVID as an option. Sometimes families don't even know that a family's member's death must even be registered. Personal burial plots are relatively common, and they don't require the permits that would require registration. Now, researchers have used many methods to fill in these gaps. They've used mobile phone surveys and counted graves on satellite images. They've even taken to asking gravediggers, as they did in the 2014 Ebola crisis. Now, Nigeria's death rate has just surpassed 100,000, and the gaps in reporting it throughout the nation are making it difficult to know how accurate this is. But as Nigerian citizens face a second wave and the nation sets its sights on 40% vaccination rates, they even have a more urgent need for accurate counting. And here's to Nigeria for actually recognizing the issue and doing something about it. And that's how we improve public health. Saving lives versus preserving it. Now, are wealthy Americans maneuvering to get the vaccine first? No, I can't imagine that that would be the case. The short answer is yes. What? But according to the New York Times, it's likely that they won't have much success. Yay. Now, high-income individuals, despite public health officials' suggestions, have traveled to vacation spots and came back with COVID. Huh. Really, I'm shocked. Now, we've seen it with social media influencers and celebrities who have a big fan base, but this time we focus on the citizens of the Upper East Side Manhattan with insights from a couple of concierge doctors. Now, with the creation of the vaccine, many healthy people are calling their doctors wanting to be vaccinated despite being low risk. One doctor actually has spoken out about the members of his practice who they feel entitled to receive the vaccine first, since they pay, in his case, $20,000 a year for round-the-clock and unlimited access to care. Now, fortunately, Governor Cuomo has put measures in to mitigate this type of behavior. Now, Governor Cuomo is threatening penalties of up to $1 million and even losing your license if you deliver the vaccine unethically. That's really good. He even proposed new legislation criminalizing giving the vaccine to anyone trying to jump ahead when we are supposed to be prioritizing healthcare and essential frontline workers. Let me also add that we need to have a strong sense of equity here as well. Now, many high-income folks feel entitled to this vaccine that is still considered in short supply to protect themselves from a disease that mostly affects the lower and middle classes. Go figure. Now, saving lives does take priority over preserving it. 100% agree with that. During this pandemic, we've witnessed so much overt inequities in public health. We should not encourage this type of behavior nor stand for it any longer. Yes, that is 100% agreed with that. You get the vaccine only when it's your turn to. And for now, continue to quarantine, continue to social distance, continue to wear masks, and avoid crowds. Yes. New research on safety on reopening schools. Now, a new study was recently published detailing the safety factors in reopening schools in the U.S. The data was conducted by a team of researchers at Tulane University. Yay, that's Doc Griggs and mine, both alma mater, and we both are professors at Tulane. But it was the Tulane University's REACH, the National Center for Research, Education, Access, and Choice. See, that's REACH. Research, Education, Access, and Choice. Now, okay. Prior to the study, much of the research on safeguards for reopening schools was based on testing data. Now, as testing continues to be unpredictable and a confounded variable, the study used hospitalization rates of different regions as a more reliable point source for their data. Now, Dr. Tulane epidemiologist and my colleague, Dr. Susan Hassig, notes that COVID infections can go more easily undetected in regions with less reliable testing. She argues for the reliability of hospitalization rates, explaining if you get infected with coronavirus, you become substantially ill, you're going to become hospitalized. Her team reviewed hospitalization data and cross-examined it with schools that reopened in the same vicinity. The team found that for regions with lower hospitalization rates, there weren't significant increases in hospitalizations after schools opened in person or they offered hybrid options. The benchmark for this group was less than 36 to 46 hospitalizations per 100,000 people, according to the study results. On the other hand, regions with relatively high hospitalization rates had more inconclusive data findings, and results showed that for some of these higher rate regions, infections were higher after reopening schools. But in other high rate regions, infections were unchanged or even lowered after reopening. So the jury's still out for these regions with higher rates of hospitalizations. This is because there are many factors at play that need to be examined. The research team also notes that the intention of the study is to simply provide more information to help educators and community leaders decide on how to proceed with schooling given the context of their surroundings. This data needs to be considered carefully as several other factors affect the safetiness of reopening schools. Let me also add that at the time of this recording, the week prior, so this was last week, The CDC did a number of studies, or actually they released a number of studies, including a viewpoint in the Journal of American Medical Association that stated that schools are actually safe to attend as long as the schools are very vigilant with respect to masking and also social distancing. In that series of three studies, they added a fourth one, and in that fourth one, they reviewed the indoor sporting events that occur in schools and particularly reviewed a wrestling match that occurred in Florida over the course of a weekend in December of 2020, and it was exceedingly clear that this wrestling match was a super spreading event. And in conclusion, they recommended that, yes, again, schools are safe to open as long as recommendations are followed to the T, but then also indoor sporting events, not good, right? And I think at this point that goes without being said. Okay, so this next study is really interesting. This was done by the CDC. Now, remember what the beginning of the pandemic, the recommendation was that if you were exposed to somebody with COVID-19, that you should go into quarantine for 14 days. And that was very, very difficult for people to do, especially if people felt well or if they tested negative. They wanted to go to work and it was hard to continue to live life when you were asked to be quarantined for a long time. And then somewhere in December, the CDC updated its quarantine guidance and they changed it from 14 days for close contacts to either 10 days if you didn't have a test or 7 days with a negative COVID-19 test. So where did they come up with that modeling data? How did they come up with that? Well, it turns out it's because from May to November, they were following Vermont. And Vermont was actually conducting a series of observations where they were looking at asymptomatic contacts. And what they found in Vermont was that they found 977 asymptomatic contacts from positive patients. So in other words, maybe at work, you're working with somebody, everybody's masked, you're in an office, but somebody is chatting with you, or you're in a meeting, and although everybody's masked, somebody turns up positive, you have to now go in quarantine even though you're asymptomatic. What they found was that 96% of those individuals tested negative after a week-long quarantine, and only 3% tested positive for COVID-19 after a week-long quarantine. So essentially what the CDC did was After Vermont concluded their study of observations, the CDC just went ahead and changed their recommendations because it followed the real-world data. And essentially, what Vermont showed us and what the CDC then turned into guidelines was that if you are the asymptomatic contact of somebody who has been exposed to somebody with COVID-19, if you do get a test and that test is negative, you can get out of quarantine after 7 days. And then if you decide not to get a test, you can get out of quarantine in 10 days. So allowing asymptomatic persons to shorten quarantine with a negative test at day 7 did not demonstrate transmission of SARS-CoV-2. However, it did support shortening the quarantine with testing as per CDC guidance. So that's great news. And it just goes to show how science does dictate good policy. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Dary and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Dary or at DRDERY. You can follow us at NoiseFilter on Instagram, NoiseFilterNola on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Portland 90.7 FM.